I'm going to have Alan Trounson come up and do a little introduction. And Alan's now running CIRM and came from Monash. But I was looking at the biography of you on the Monash site, which I thought was rather amusing beginning. It says, Alan Trounce is a world-renowned IVF pioneer and stem cell biologist who began his career undertaking research not in human reproduction, but with females of the woolly kind. So I suppose that refers to the sheep that you were working with. So Alan Trounson, you can find out more about him in your little guidebooks here. But Alan is now going to introduce our keynote speaker, John Gurdon. Alan, thank you.
I hope you don't send that to Australia, because all my girlfriends all sort of wonder what you're talking about, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here, and I think I've been to all of the meetings on the Mesa, and I think you're actually going to have to get a bigger auditorium, Roger. Maybe we can expand the sulk a little, Rusty, just to sort of squeeze it out a bit. Anyway, my job here is to introduce you to Sir John Gurdon, and it's a real pleasure to do that. John's a British developmental biologist, and you'll recognise that as soon as you hear him speak. Best known for pioneering research in nuclear transplantation and cloning. He attended Eton College and then studied with Michael Fishberg at Oxford and then did postdoctoral work at Caltech. His early posts were at the Department of Zoology and the University of Oxford, 1962-71. He spent most of his research career at Cambridge, first at the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology, 71-83, that's 1971-1983, and then at the Department of Zoology, the University of Cambridge, in 1983 until now. In 1989, he was a founding member of the Wellcome CRC Institute for Cell Biology and Cancer, which was later named the Wellcome CRC UK in Cambridge, and was its chair until 2001. He was Master of Magdalene College, Cambridge, from 1995 to 2002. In 1962, Sir John, then at Oxford University, showed for the first time that the nucleus of a fully differentiated adult intestinal cell could be used to clone the South African clawed frog, the Xenopus larvis. This was the first demonstration in animals that the nucleus of a differentiated cell retains the total potential to develop in all cells of the body, to be reprogrammed. And he paved the way for the future somatic cell nuclear transfer experiments that included the 1996 cloning of the sheep. It was in 1974 to 1977 that I was at Cambridge, and in the same laboratories with Ian Wilmut, who actually did the Dolly the Sheep experiments, and Ian and Steen Villardson, possibly lesser known but maybe more brilliant, who did a lot of cloning, and the best known of that was, a lot of chimeric work. He made chimeras of sheep, goat, and other things. So we thought, we were doing experiments where we were inspired for what John was doing in Xenopus, and we thought that he was the best scientist in the world at that time. So as young people, he was something very special to all of us. His experiments really did capture the attention of the scientific community, and the tools and techniques he developed for nuclear transfer are still in use today. He and his colleagues also pioneered the use of Xenopus eggs and oocytes to translate microinjected messenger RNA, a technique which has been widely used to identify the proteins encoded and to study their function. His recent research has focused on analysing intercellular signalling factors involved in cell differentiation and on elucidating the mechanisms involved in reprogramming the nucleus in transplantation experiments, including demethylation of the transplanted DNA. John was made a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1971. He was knighted in 1995. In 2004, the Wellcome CRC UK Institute for Cell Biology and Cancer was renamed the Gurdon Institute in his honour. He's also received numerous other awards, medals and honorary degrees, and he was awarded the 2009 Albert Lasker Basic Medical Research Award. It's truly a real pleasure and I think a real inspiration for me and many other people in the world to hand over to someone very special, Sir John Gurdon.
So thank you, Alan, for your very kind introduction, and it's a great pleasure to be invited to this splendid CIRM meeting and the land of permanent summer. The idea of the work that I'd like to talk about in the end is to try and achieve something like this, where you start with adult tissue-like skin or intestine, nuclear transfer to egg, reprogramming, and then having got back to the embryo stage to take these cells and redirect them towards cell types that are unrelated to the one you started with, all under conditions of no immunosuppression and hence cell replacement with genetically identical cells. That's the aim of this direction of work. Now, there are three routes towards this kind of nuclear reprogramming: somatic cell nuclear transfer, cell fusion, and induced pluripotency. I would like to concentrate on the first two of these, nuclear transfer and some reference to cell fusion. And the reason for doing this is that we're looking at natural reprogramming components. These turn out to work rapidly and efficiently, and they can do so without cell division and without cell selection. So there is, I believe, a certain interest in the nature and mode of operation of these natural reprogramming components. And there are really two questions. One is, what are these egg components that reprogram nuclei? And secondly, and actually very importantly, what are the components of somatic cell nuclei that make them resistant to reprogramming by eggs? And what I'll do is to talk about three points. One is the efficiency of reprogramming and the converse of that, which is the phenomenon we call epigenetic memory. And then I'll talk a little bit about meiotic prophase oocytes as a route to understanding what these components may be. And finally, draw some comparison with IPS and the whole process of redifferentiating the derived embryonic cells. So starting off with a bit of background, the design of a nuclear transplant experiment to eggs is start with something like skin, separate the cells, transplant the nucleus to the enucleated egg, and in some cases grow an adult. And the same principle applies to mammals, in which this process works for fairly large number, not quite all, but somewhere between 10 and 20 kinds of mammals, this process does work. So just to remind you of one key point, which is that one can start with the nucleus of a differentiated cell rather than embryonic cell, and this is a muscle cell. You may see the myofibril running right the way through that cell, and there is the nucleus of the cell. Now that nucleus can be transplanted to enucleated eggs, and you derive larvae, this one from a fertilized egg, that one from, in this case, a muscle cell. And if you look at the eye of the tadpole derived from the muscle cell nucleus, it's actually an entirely normal eye with a lens, correctly arranged layers of retina, and so on. But of course, each cell has the nucleus, which is the direct descendant of the nucleus of the muscle cell. And that's what we really mean by reprogramming. So to cut a longish story short, the question is, how efficiently does that work? And when you add up what are called first nuclear transfers, serial nuclear transfers are when you take the first nuclear transfer embryo, which is often abnormal, and retransplant its nuclei, you can then get a fair degree of normal development, and you can graft tissue from defective early embryos, as a result of which one can work out that the efficiency of reprogramming from one cell type to an entirely unrelated one is about 30%. So in this case, we're saying, how often can you go from nuclei of intestinal epithelium to functional muscle and nerve? And it's about 30%, which is not perfect, but it's quite a high efficiency ratio. Now, that's quite important, because if you want to understand the mechanism of a process, it's really almost essential to have a high efficiency of reprogramming. It would be very difficult if you're working with a tiny minority of nuclear transplants which succeed, because you wouldn't know which ones to look at. So that's an important point about efficiency. And I like to refer to this experiment of James Byrne and others, where it combines nuclear transfer with ESL technology. In this case, he took a monkey and its egg and eggs from and skin from one monkey, eggs from another. They have to be the same species. It doesn't work if they're not. And then grew the embryonic stem cells. And incidentally, that experiment, to my knowledge, was first done by Alan Trunson quite a while back in a paper that's not really been sufficiently recognized, to grow embryonic stem cells from nuclear transplants. So having done that, you can then expand the embryonic stem cells considerably. And in this case, he then added factors and derived beating heart cells. So illustrating rather nicely the connection between nuclear transfer or cloning and embryonic stem cells. And it works very well in the monkeys. So one assumes that it could, in principle, work in humans. So let me now draw conclusions from this sort of somewhat introductory part of the talk. And of course, the first point is that the genome is conserved during cell differentiation. And one should remember that that was why these experiments were first done in the 1950s, because at that time one didn't actually know whether all cells had the same genome or they didn't, and that's why it was done. So the idea of clones was really a byproduct of that. That wasn't why the experiments started. And the other second point I think is quite interesting, and that says that cell differentiation is continually maintained by a cyclic nucleocytoplasmic exchange, meaning that when you put a nucleus from one cell into the cytoplasm of another, like an egg, or indeed, if you fuse two cells together, relatively rapidly, the cytoplasm of a cell will switch the nucleus to its own pattern of gene expression. And so it implies that there is a continuous process within a cell by which components are cycling between nucleus and cytoplasm and trying to reset the genetic program of the nucleus. And that conclusion emerges really very clearly from nuclear transplant and cell fusion experiments. So that takes us to the next point, and I call this epigenetic memory. And the reason for interest in this is to ask why it is that the nuclear transfer procedure does not work perfectly. One might expect that it would if there is a continuous recycling of information between nucleus and cytoplasm. For example, in the mammal, a nucleus is transplanted into an egg, and it has nearly 24 hours before the egg even divides once. So the exchange of molecules within the cell, and indeed the exchange of molecules between DNA, chromosomal proteins and DNA, is generally thought to be rapid. FRAP experiments indicate this is in the order of seconds or minutes. So 24 hours should be ample to completely reprogram a nucleus, but actually it doesn't work that well. So the question is, why not? And these are now experiments that show, I think, some light on that. So this is a general conclusion from all nuclear transplant experiments, and that is that when you start with the nucleus of an embryonic cell, you get this relatively high success rate. So in mammals, you get birth in something like 30%. In frogs, it reaches the swimming, feeding tadpole stage in about the same proportion. But when you start with nuclei from adult cells, that success rate goes right down, maybe 10 to 20 times less successful, even though the nuclei you transplant are part of the, are surrounded by the same kind of cytoplasm. So why should that be? And there's one experiment that shows, gives some light on that, and that is of the following kind. One starts with essentially a muscle cell, transplants its nucleus to the enucleated egg, grows the embryo, and then divides that embryo into the part which will form muscle or nerve, the neuroectoderm, isolate that bit, or another bit which forms the endoderm or gut, and remove completely the part that would form muscle. And then you assay gene expression in the nerve cells, neuroectoderm cells, or in the gut cells, and find that in about half the cases there is a vast overexpression of muscle genes, never normally expressed in these cells. So these cells somehow remember that they started life as a muscle cell. Meantime, they have undergone some 12 cell divisions, no transcription, and yet when they start up, they somehow remember where they came from. And the idea is that this is this memory is interfering with the efficient reprogramming. So what could be the basis of that memory? And one particular molecule seems to be quite important, and it's called histone H3.3. Now, the normal core histone H3 is actually very similar. There's only four amino acid differences. But this histone has a different chaperone, and it's synthesized throughout the cell cycle, unlike the core histone. And this one is very strongly transcription-related. It seems to be heavily involved wherever transcription is active. And so what we think is happening is that this H3.3 histone, which is extremely abundant in eggs, promotes the continuation of any gene which is active when introduced into the egg. So this is the concept. Eggs have an exceptionally high content of this variant histone, and that most cells don't. Now, the egg histone maintains the open state of active genes in transplanted nuclei. Now, that's not a problem in normal fertilization, because the sperm has no active genes, and only when you introduce a somatic nucleus with some genes active do you have the problem that this transcription promoting factor now makes them continue to be transcribed. And this open gene state promoted by H3.3 seems to cause memory during the early cell divisions. So that seems to be a kind of explanation of why some nuclear transplants seem not to work because of this very special component of eggs. Now, I now move on to the second part of the talk, and I need to talk about these so-called first meiotic prophase oocytes, because they are very valuable in beginning to disentangle the mechanisms of reprogramming. The experiment that I've mentioned so far is of this kind: transplant a nucleus to an egg, grow the embryo, and in some cases an animal, adult animal. But the reprogramming process we're interested in is one that's happening sometime there. We don't know when. We do know that this is a time of intense DNA replication, no transcription, followed by transcription. At that point, the reprogramming has happened. So it's very difficult to disentangle what is happening at that point. So what we now do is to take the growing egg cell called an oocyte, and I'll say more about that. In this case, you can transplant somatic nuclei into the so-called germinal vesicle of this cell, and they stay there. And during that time, there is no replication at all, so that gets that out of the way. And there is intense transcription. And at the end of this time, these nuclei have now been reprogrammed and express the the pluripotency genes. So it's an inherently simple process. Now this germinal vesicle looks like that, a large, huge structure actually, about the size of 100,000 cells. And it lives inside the growing egg cell, you can't see it there. And that germinal vesicle has a vast abundance of components which are needed for normal development. So when the oocyte converts itself into the so-called egg, fertilizable egg, these are dispersed, they enter the embryo, and they are necessary for normal development. So we're using this natural stockpile of developmentally important components that have reprogramming activity to try and find out what they are and how they work. Now, when you transplant nuclei into this germinal vesicle, if you're using nuclei from very rapidly dividing cells, and mammal cells work just as well as frog cells, they reprogram remarkably quickly, within about half a day. On the other hand, if you use the nuclei very differentiated cells, like thymus, they take a great deal longer. It's just the same as in the experiments with eggs. So one should say that this oocyte procedure does not actually make you a new cell. What it does do is to reset transcription in the absence of protein synthesis, without DNA synthesis, and without cell division. So it simplifies the problem of asking what are these components, shown in blue, sitting there, which enter these nuclei and switch them right back to pluripotency gene expression. And that's the topic I'm now going to discuss. So these are the mechanisms that we think are involved, and I'll take them one at a time. Excuse me. The first thing is that there is, as I've mentioned, a resistance to reprogramming when you start with nuclei of specialized cells. This is partly due to demethylation of DNA, notably the promoter of OCT4. Now, this process does happen. Eggs and oocytes can do that, but it's slow and it's incompletely efficient. So one of the difficulties of this reprogramming seems to be the slow and relatively inefficient demethylation of DNA. But that's not everything, because there are a number of examples where this inefficient reprogramming takes place when there is no methylation of DNA. So that's only part of the story. Then there are substantial changes, epigenetic changes to genes. So here we have gene regulatory regions which are methylated, actually it's proteins, after nuclear transfer. And this can only be found out because it's possible to do chip analysis on transplanted nuclei in the system. It wouldn't be in any other. So you recover the nuclei and then ask what changes there have been made to the promoters of these genes. And all you need to look at is the red and or green bars reflecting the H3K4 diol-trimethyl state of the histones. And these are strong in promoter regions of reprogrammed genes, SOX2 regulatory region, CEL4. They're not pronounced in the coding region, and notably, they do not occur in one of those particular genes which is not reprogrammed. So this seems to be a process which is important and effective in reprogramming, and one of the mechanisms that's important. Now, the next thing to mention is chromatin decondensation. And in the case of normal fertilization, the sperm, shown by the green spots, undergo the most amazing amount of chromatin dispersion and expansion. So there's the sperm nucleus, and in this mouse nucleus, there's the male pronucleus short time after. So there's a massive expansion and dispersion of chromatin. And that happens in these nuclear transfer experiments also. These are cultured cell nuclei transplanted to the oocyte germinal vesicle. Germinal vesicle would look something like that, a few hundred of these transplanted, and they undergo a massive expansion of 20 to 30 times. Each of those blows up, and the chromatin becomes highly dispersed. And that seems to be a necessary event in the reprogramming. We interpret that as a kind of opening up of the chromatin, essentially exposing it to all sorts of factors which are present in the egg or oocyte. Now, the next thing to consider is protein-DNA exchange, and this is also a very important process. We can measure that in a number of ways by FRAP analysis in this system, and it's certainly happens quickly. But one of the most important steps, perhaps even the most important early step in the reprogramming, is the substitution of the linker histones. Now, in this particular video you'll see in a moment, we've started with somatic nuclei containing the somatic linker histone, happens to be called H1O, and these nuclei are green because they contain this linker histone. These are what they're like when they're when they're immediately after nuclear transfer. Now, these have been implanted into an oocyte which contains a high abundance of the oocyte-specific linker histone called B4RFP. That's present there. And that's done by, as Alan Transfer mentioned, you use messenger RNA to heavily overexpress this. And so these oocytes are loaded up with an excess of the oocyte-specific linker histone marked with RFP. And you should see the exchange occurring relatively rapidly. It's gone back to the beginning again, but you could see they became red, almost all of them became red. Now that process happens extraordinarily quickly. This is shows the loss of the somatic linker histone, the gain of the oocyte-specific one, and it's something around 2 hours, which at the frog temperature is about 40 minutes by mammalian temperature. So it's an extremely quick process, and this process is necessary for reprogramming. One of the problems we have in this field is you can't do gene knockdowns because the proteins are there. You can't do message depletion because the proteins are there. So you have to do a depletion either by antibodies or by dominant negatives. But in this case, we can see the reprogrammed gene SOX2 works well. But if you do the dominant negative or the antibody, that essentially eliminates the reprogramming. And the pale blue is the housekeeping gene for doesn't need reprogramming for comparison. So this is an example where that process is actually necessary. Now, after that has all happened, surprisingly, you get a global transcriptional opening up of the genome. And to our surprise, all sorts of genes like muscle genes, neural genes, of course, housekeeping genes, stem cell genes, are all strongly transcriptionally activated, as if the oocyte is de-repressing the genome and transcribing almost everything. That seems to be how that works. So we eventually want to work towards a time course of these events. And this is really a very early beginning, but you can see that eventually we should be able to piece together the events which bring about this reprogramming. And I would like to think that that will turn out to be what I call a deterministic process, in contrast to what several people have described for IPS as a stochastic process, meaning that if we know what molecules are involved, what their abundance is, and how they go into a nucleus and change it, we should in principle understand how reprogramming is done. And at the moment, this rather sketchy plan seems to be true. This is now at mammalian temperature. Within 45 minutes, the linker and histones are exchanged. Heterochromatin 1 is lost. Histone 8.3.3 and nucleoplasmin are incorporated. We work a bit with the repressed X and exist is lost. Then methylation of histones takes place later, and only considerably later do you actually get new gene transcription. So eventually, it seems to me, we should be able to piece that together, but that's how the skeleton of it is beginning to look at the moment. So now let me comment on some general properties of this process and relate this to other reprogramming routes. So this is the famous Yamanaka IPS route, where you take skin, Yamanaka factors, and we program directly to embryonic stem cells and derive these different derivatives. Now that it was really preceded by work in the blood series, and even earlier than that by Weintraub and Mayo-D, where overexpressing factors can switch within a limited range from one blood route to another by overexpressing transcription factors. And more recently, Doug Milton has been able to show that you can switch directly between two types of pancreas. So the the later you carry out the switch in development, the less effective it is. It can only switch between limited cell types. Now, the experiments I've mentioned with eggs look like this. Here we take skin, go back to the egg, and then embryo, and then into these different types. And the last experiments I mentioned with the oocyte, where you go back right to the pre-egg stage, the oocyte stage, and then you get complete reprogramming. Can't follow that step, but the reprogramming is more complete. And so we reach the general conclusion that the extent of nuclear reprogramming is greatest using signals from the earliest stages of development. So there seem to exist, in the very early stages of development, factors which have this reprogramming activity. And in a way, the further back we go, the more complete and efficient the process seems to be. So to summarize the main points, and in the last minute, I have one other point to make after this, but these are the general points that I think emerge from this work. Cell differentiation is continuously maintained by cyclic intracellular signaling, and of course a constant genome. Nuclear transfer to eggs and oocytes and cell fusion are mechanistically different, we believe, from IPS. Nuclear reprogramming is enhanced by egg components and inhibited by donor chromatin, the kind of eggs trying to reprogram against the resistance acquired by during cell differentiation by nuclei and chromatin. And I suppose we hope that eventually the natural reprogramming components that I've been talking about may be useful for regenerative medicine. Now, just before sitting down, let me say, you may say, well, all very well, when you've gone back to the beginning by this process, how do you ever go forward again? And in normal development, there are two fundamental mechanisms for cell differentiation. One is the asymmetric distribution of components in the egg or cell. So one end has red, the other one has yellow, the other blue. That's the asymmetric distribution of components between daughter cells. And the second is the signaling between cells. So blue then signals to yellow by creating green. So endoderm signals to future ectoderm and makes mesoderm. Those are the two fundamental processes of normal development. And when you have, in my view, completely reprogrammed a somatic nucleus right back to the beginning, then you're in a position to apply these processes, which are beginning to be fairly well understood, to redirect the nuclei towards the desired cell types. Just let me mention people whose work I particularly mentioned at the moment. Stina Siemens and James Byrne did the early reprogramming of mammalian nuclei. Ray Ing did the work with epigenetic memory. And Jerome Julian and my colleagues, Karina Astron, Vincent Pask, and Richard Hallis-Stott, have been involved in the more recent work that I've mentioned. Thank you.
So, time for a couple of questions before we go to the next panel. That'll have to be very quick. And if you have something to say, please wait till we get a microphone to you, because all this goes onto tape, and you won't be heard otherwise. Larry, you have a question. Larry Goldstein.
So John, would you predict that if you were able to transcriptionally silence a differentiated nucleus, that would speed up and enhance the efficiency?
Yes. Yes, that's a very, very good question. If you transcriptionally silence the unwanted genes, can that help things? I think it would eliminate the epigenetic memory. That's what that would do. Now, just how important that is, I guess it will help, but I don't think it's going to be everything. I think there are more fundamental components sitting in chromatin, which we don't yet know, which somehow help to prevent the reprogramming. So that's part of it, but not everything, in my view.
We can pick up some of these questions later on. Is this very quick?
Great.
Okay, so according to your model, it would be possible in the older phenotype that has many senescent cell types to begin to induce exogenous growth factor matrices to reverse some of the senescence.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And that's a route that we're now following, because with this regime I mentioned, you can indeed treat nuclei with various things and then inject them and ask if you, to what extent the removal or addition of individual components has helped the process. So that's exactly the way forward.